Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Accessed entry 867.1C1526, certificate number 44164, Hiroo Onoda.
I think that the smooth jazz from behind is going to add an extra element to the show, too, that I'm going to really like.
Would you have picked a different topic if you had known?
I'm just going to go, yeah, actually.
This show is now about Dean Martin.
So as part of Omnibus, we've been kind of going through recycling all of the topics that captivated us as kids and as teens. We're basically putting everything into a time capsule that we fear might get lost. And a lot of those things typically were the topics of Time Life books in the 1970s.
The formative work for Gen X childhood.
We've never actually done a show on Bigfoot or Yetis or the Bermuda Triangle.
We have absolutely done Sasquatch.
And also the Bermuda Triangle and Yetis. We've not done any of those shows that I still remember. But we definitely grew up in a time when we still felt that there was a lot of mystery in the world. A lot of... Maybe we here in the room are the last people to really think of the Earth as having places that... are undiscovered. No one's ever been to this particular part of the Amazon jungle, and that may not be true in another 50
years. Yeah, I mean, digital mapping alone changed the optics. Yeah. The fact that I can right now see an aerial view of every square mile on Earth really does something to mystery and romance.
It does. I not to get so dark right away, but I was looking up a person I knew that had died and clicked through to their... to the cemetery where they're buried, and then was able to aerially view the gravestone, and it's just like 50 miles down the road here. And on the way here today, I drove past it and looked over and was like, the gravestone's right about there. And I'm like, well, I couldn't have done that 5 years ago. Not sure that I needed to. Not sure that's healthy or good for me, but there it is. But we grew up. Obviously, my parents grew up in a world where whole big quadrants of the globe still were unmapped. And
terra incognita.
Yeah, and a lot of our imaginations were formed in this time, right, where it was conceivable that there would be an area near the island of Bermuda where ships and planes would go in and never come out.
Or some plateau in South America that still has dinosaurs. I mean, there's lots of options.
Right.
All killed by Google Maps. Thanks, Google Maps.
But one of the things I remember very distinctly from my childhood was the idea, and I don't know how it got in there at first, but the idea that in the South Pacific, there were still now elderly Japanese soldiers living in the jungle... who didn't know World War II had ended.
So when would this have been, your childhood meaning?
1970s into the 1980s. And, you know, it kind of overlapped then with, in the 80s, you remember a lot of the conversation around the Vietnam War was that we had still had a lot of American soldiers that were being held in bamboo cages in Vietnam somewhere. As unlikely as that would be, just in terms of a resource allocation question for the Vietnamese soldiers. Is this where you're going to want to put your
bamboo,
your time and effort? A lot of other things you could be doing besides keeping like four pilots in a cage. I'm not one of those MIA POW truthers. Just in case anybody in the back is like sharpening their Air Force knife.
But think of all the Stallone movies and Chuck Norris movies we would not have had without those fine people.
And the premise, right, that there are people in the jungle who were initially there as part of a war, either captive or escaped, who because of the impenetrableness of the jungle and its great distance from shipping lanes or modern life, that it's conceivable that people would be there and not know that time had moved on.
Do you remember where you first saw the notion of Japanese holdouts still fighting the war?
You know, my dad was in World War II and fought in the South Pacific. He was a Navy pilot, and he had all kinds of stories of, you know, kind of island hopping with the Navy and the U.S. Marines as they gradually made their way closer and closer to Japan. And so, as a kid, I grew up watching every kind of World War II movie there was with my dad and was very interested in it culturally. But it entered into the sort of public... sort of...
Zeitgeist?
Let's say zeitgeist.
Don't miss a chance to say zeitgeist.
When was the last time either of us said it?
I said it at 10 this morning. I try to say zeitgeist 3 times a day.
I want to see a show of hands. What, has anyone said zeitgeist in the last month? Oh, wow. Look at all you smarty pants.
12. Okay, last week. Anybody in the last week?
Yeah, look at that. There's still like
a couple.
12 to 15 people that
the
claim.
The most recent person to say zeitgeist here wins the door prize.
That's you.
Oh, yeah. I love this raffle.
But how did any of that stuff get into our heads, right?
Well, I actually remember the first time I saw this, and it is a movie. Like, you were mentioning seeing these, you know, World War II type, Hell in the Pacific and so forth. But in my case, it was the, 1980 Walt Disney Pictures release, The Last Flight of Noah's Ark.
Yes.
Any big Elliot Gould fans out there? So it's a plot point in this movie that, which is just some kind of dumb African Queen ripoff, I think. I had to look to see if it was Elliot Gould, because for a moment I was afraid it might be Bill Bixby. It's one of those Disney movies. And there are, as a comic relief sideline, there are two kind of confused Japanese soldiers who need to be persuaded that that they can come out now, that it all ended a long time ago.
And they're not dangerous, the two Japanese soldiers. They're
no, in this
baffled.
In this case, they're baffled, and, you know, do they believe us? And it's a funny sidelight because, come on, that was decades ago, guys.
Well, in fact, the reason that could be a plot point in a 1980 Disney movie is that it was still, I think, into the 80s, still somewhat plausible that there continued to be now soldiers in their 50s, or I'm sorry, soldiers in their 60s, living in the jungle, you know, wearing clothes made of tattered Japanese army uniforms, still sneaking in, you know, raiding local villages. And it actually was an idea that was very meaningful within Japan. Japan was going in the 70s, going through a period of great self-reflection because the economy had grown so fast, and, you know, Japan obviously spearheaded a kind of modernity in culture and electronics, and, you know, Japan from the end of World War II to 1980. Arguably made an unthinkably quick...
Unprecedented
progression from a feudal society to a hyper-modern one. And there was a lot of questioning, kind of like we're doing now. Is this right? Have we gone too far? Have we lost our traditional ways? Have we forgotten what's good about a simple life? There was a lot of that happening in the late 60s in Japan. And the few people we're going to talk about here who kind of reappeared on the scene, still practicing, still maintaining a kind of ancient worldview, and a lot of these ideas of honor and tradition that, you know, maybe don't hold up to too much scrutiny.
Or have their downsides.
Or have their downsides, right. I mean, in terms of if you're going to base your life on honor, it's hard to then also, like, be a gorilla. And by that I mean someone fighting, like a war of burning down people's huts, right? Honor takes a lot of different forms.
So you're saying there were actually... This was not invented by, was it Bill Bixby?
Yeah, it was Bill Bixby.
Elliot Gould. Like, there were actual cases of these guys turning up that late?
Well, so, at the end of World War II, at the height of, in 1943, the Japanese Empire encompassed over 20% of the population of the Earth.
Wow.
They,
I mean, invading China gives you a real leg up. Like... You know, our equivalent is we would invade Canada and we'd be like, good news, you just got another 0.05% population-wise.
And yet, you control 40% of the world's cheese.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Think of your maple syrup stores.
But also, you know, they controlled the Philippines and Indonesia. And in the South Pacific, there are almost 30,000 islands. Not all of them inhabited, but you know, it's archipelago.
That's 30, to put it a different way, that's 30 bottles of dressing. If you can. I like how you were actually going to make a point, and I was like, let me just interrupt you. I have something incredibly stupid to add.
So toward the end of the war, the Japanese strategy was, look, we lost all of our aircraft carriers at Midway. We're not really going to be able to fight the advancing American juggernaut with conventional methods. And so they started to plan ahead. We're going to make this very difficult on the Americans. It's nearly impossible to retake every one of those little atolls.
If we dig in, they'll have to island hop. And
that's right. And so
that's years of their what do you say? What's the expression? Time and riches, or isn't there some? Isn't
oh,
there some military
yeah. Thing? What is blood and blood and treasure?
Blood and treasure. Yeah. That's it.
That's one of the euphemisms that you learn. People actually in the State Department or in the U.S. Army actually use the phrase "blood and treasure."
What's the opposite of a euphemism? Like, because you could easily say effort and materiel. But they're like, wouldn't it be like a little more bitchin' if we said blood and treasure?
Blood and treasure. Well, I don't think they're, other than the Treasury Department, you don't use the word treasure very often. Who's the last person in here that used the word treasure? Okay.
Guy with a hook and a peg leg is like, raises his hook.
My daughter was saying that one of the things that makes Washington State special is that we have an unusual number of islands compared to most U.S. states.
Yeah. Woo!
Minnesota's got lakes. We've got islands, right? Maine also has islands, but I don't think they have nearly the islands that we have.
We have really quality islands.
We do. We have good islands. So as the Japanese tried to imagine a strategy where they were going to be able to defeat the United States and hold on to their empire, they started to train soldiers to participate in this kind of rear action stuff. They were going to have little teams that were going to stay on the islands. Sure, the American Marines might land, but then in the night, these sapper teams would come blow up the airfield or sink the boats. And by this method, make it almost impossible for the American military to make it all the way to Japan. What they didn't anticipate was that the American military, foreseeing this, just ignored 85% of those islands.
Hey, we have all this tripwire. Yeah, you guys are just flying over it?
Yeah, they kind of made a study of the area, and they said, we actually don't need any one of those 50 islands. We're just going to go to this one and then the next one.
So the battles that we know of as kind of these iconic gutting it out for an airfield, you know, Iwo Jima or Guadalcanal, those are the exception. You know, we need one airfield in this region. We're going to go all out to take Mount Suribachi, but there's like 30 other Iwo Jimas that we're not going to bother with.
Yep, all those islands had little garrisons all ready to push the Americans back, and they just watched the ships sail by.
It's like supermarket sweep. You've only got 2 minutes or whatever it is. You got to go for the ham or the steak or whatever. You know, there's whole aisles full of box dinners that nobody, that people are just going to ignore. You're like, nope, I want the Iwo Jima of the freezer case.
Well, and how many of you have recently seen Oppenheimer, the movie?
3 times!
Yeah, there you go. 3 times.
I don't know if that's anything to brag about, man. But it's like, isn't that 10 hours of your life with trailers?
As I look here, I see that I'm related to this person. So that it's a nerd family.
But I'm such a good ally, I went to Barbie instead. Like, and obviously came straight from there, you can see, but...
Yeah, when he showed up backstage, I was like, if we were dressing like ice cream cones, I have a whole wardrobe.
Like, if your name is Ken, you get in free if you're wearing this much pink.
But one of the big justifications for using nuclear weapons against the Japanese at the end of the war was this idea that it would be impossible to actually defeat the far-flung Japanese Empire by conventional invasion. You know, it would have cost millions of lives.
And to be fair, that's not a unanimous take. Like,
no.
After watching Oppenheimer, I was like, I'm going to get into this. Why did Stimson think the Japanese were close to surrender? And there were lots of high-placed people, including Eisenhower, who were like, we do not have to do this.
Including Einstein, right? But there's also the problem of revisionism with anything where you're like, well, yeah, sure, you had to be in the room, I guess. Although, I don't know about... Well, let's not
you
argue...
You folks did not come to an arts festival for this, I promise.
So at the end of the war, it was not even the end of the war. There were quite a few of these early American victories on islands as they progressed to recapture the Philippines and all the different archipelagos, that when a Japanese garrison would be defeated, the survivors would retreat into the mountains and begin a guerrilla war against the invaders. Now, of course, the Japanese were the invaders. This is two colonial powers fighting one another.
invaders.
Yeah, on an island where the local residents were just trying to, you know, survive. But there are examples of Japanese troops who were fighting the war from cave outposts for the whole last year of the war, who continued to fight it and legitimately didn't know that the war had ended.
In many cases, was there no one to fight, given the American strategy of, we'll skip that island?
This is the other problem. In a war like World War II, where there are great coalitions of people fighting, it's hard to tell whether if you're on a Philippine island, for instance, and you see some Filipino men, are they police, soldiers, villagers, undercover angels?
So these guys are just making trouble for local authorities.
The idea being that if you just are blowing up infrastructure, it's just like you would parachute behind enemy lines and blow up the trains or whatever. If you still think that, if it's more of a global sense of what a war is, particularly if your sense is us against everybody.
War is more of a vibe than a strategy, I think.
So, you know, quite famously, I mean, not famously, but famously within those of us who spend a lot of time looking at Japanese troop movements in the 1940s.
It's very rare to find someone our age who likes talking about World War II a lot. So you guys are in luck. Like, knowing John has been great preparation for the time in my life when I will inevitably get really into World War II for no reason. I feel like, because you've always been that age.
I have been that age.
You were born one of those guys
since
somehow.
I was 7. I see more model trains in your future.
Because,
you know, you build the little houses and play with the little people.
I like that better, actually.
In December of 1945, so the war has now been over for 6 months-ish, 46 men came out of the jungles on Saipan, who had been waging a guerrilla war for over a year. the Battle of Saipan had happened in 1944, and they had retreated. 44 people had retreated into the jungle, set up a camp, and had continued to fight. The war ended. Nobody told them, apparently. Seems like something you could have just shouted over the fence at them.
Were there attempts to tell them?
The war's over!
Because there are other Japanese forces on the island that did surrender, presumably.
Well, and so one of the things that in thinking about this, you really have to. I mean, I don't know that it's possible to fully understand the degree to which the principle of never surrendering was something that really governed the thinking of the Japanese military in particular, but also, you know, it was at the time a militaristic culture.
And they're just kids.
A lot of them trained from teenage years. I mean, this is an era where suicide attacks were considered very, very in keeping with your military principles. And we're wrestling with it even in modern times. If you are in a conflict with someone who believes that when they die, they're going to go be treated as a hero in heaven, it's hard to dissuade them by saying,
"I'll kill you."
Yeah. Wouldn't you rather be in a prison camp? That's like not as enticing as it might be to somebody like me who would say, prison camp. I mean, I could see ups and downs, you know.
Yeah, that's...
I'm sure there are a lot of cool people there.
Like at that point, you're at a decision where you've reached a point in your life where there's not a lot of good options if somebody's offering you a prison camp. So it might be the least bad spot.
I mean, for those of us who live like looking, craving new experience, I feel like prison camp is something I'd check off. Like, sure.
Is this why you dressed in black? Because you're now a... You're a Johnny Cash type romantic prison guy.
If the shit goes down in here, I know where to go, out the back.
So are these people who they haven't been told the war is over? They've been told and don't believe it. Maybe they've been told and don't care because their ethos of "I keep fighting" actually supersedes any particular geopolitical reality.
So you've hit on it exactly, right? There, particularly if you believe that your enemy is waging a propaganda war against you. Mm. The idea that people telling you the war is over are messing with your head, like that's what they want you to think type of thing. And it's all embroiled in a kind of conspiratorial mindset that they would hear repeatedly that the war was over from a wide variety of sources, but were conditioned not to believe it. And obviously, these are all resourceful and intelligent people. Some of them had been trained in counter-espionage in Japanese academies and sent to do precisely this work.
Right.
But their knowledge of how you would use a campaign of deception to confuse your enemy was only confusing them, because they would get these letters that would say, "Listen, I talked to your mom. She wants you to come home, hero." And he'd go, "Well, that's clearly a doctored photograph of my mom."
that's what they want me to think.
So a lot of people in the 1940s, a lot of groups of soldiers kept appearing on these islands, kind of coming out of the jungle. In 1946, 20 men came out of a tunnel complex on Corregidor. And what had happened was they found a newspaper clipping blowing in the wind. And the randomness of it was enough to make them go, if this was espionage, that was pretty clever.
Why would I have Marmaduke on the back if this were fake?
So that was 1946. In 47, a group of 33 soldiers on Peleliu actually attacked a group of U.S. Marines. And I think the U.S. Marines were like,
We'd rather not.
Yeah, we got no beef with you guys. And they summoned a Japanese admiral to come and explain, like, you're not surrendering, I'm decommissioning you.
Oh, that's nice.
It does seem like those 33, when you read the account, they attacked U.S. Marines, but no one died. It feels like it might have been a little bit of one of those, like, I think maybe the war is over. Why don't we go attack?
Let's go charge out and see what happens.
Rawr!
Well, I mean, best case scenario, they've been living in tunnels and caves for years. They're not the best equipped or healthiest army.
Well, you might be surprised.
Ooh, what do we got?
This continues through the early 40s. I'm sorry. Into the early 50s of people, of kind of groups of ragtag soldiers who had made a little village for themselves. And because they were on an island or in a place on an island where no one else, I mean, no American soldiers had any interest in going and rooting them out.
Yeah.
They just kind of ended up wandering in over time. But it did get into the public imagination. Oh, right. On all those tens of thousands of little jungle encampments, there are still people out there that maybe don't have radios, right? Or maybe haven't gotten the info.
I mean, this is very vivid since we're having this conversation at Fort Worden, surrounded by World War II era bunkers and emplacements. Have you guys wandered the bluffs here and seen the stuff? I mean, they are kind of dark and cave-like, and those are big frontline Army right. Corps of Engineers projects. Those are not guerrilla warfare. It's very easy to imagine people hunkering down for years.
I mean, this fort was built to guard against Canadians coming to steal our pigs. They're right there. You know how many kinds of bacon they have in Canada?
But successful. Like, not a single Japanese attack of the Olympic Peninsula. I think we can all agree because of the fine men of Fort Worden. Like, mm-hmm. Nothing else I can credit it to.
But it was in the 1950s that we first started to see people come out of the jungle, where it was clear that there was something really, really weird happening. In 1955, a man by the name of Noburo Kinoshita was discovered on Luzon.
Philippines.
And he had been living alone in the jungle for over 10 years. He was captured, still sort of in a combat mentality. And when he realized that the war was over, it was less important to him than that he had been captured, and he committed suicide, hung himself.
Do you think this is because is there a moment of the war is over? What was I doing for 10 years? Or it's really just the dishonor of...
The dishonor of being captured.
Wow.
Was something that he was so convinced that honor above all. He felt very ashamed at having been captured, at having quote unquote surrendered.
If there was solitude in a lot of these cases, you can really see the training kind of snowball and reinforce itself and mix in with other kinds of mental illness that crop up when you're in a jungle for 10 years.
Yeah, The Japanese understood that this was happening, right? The people in Japan, I mean, think of the tens and tens of thousands of people that died in the war that are missing and gone and declared dead. I mean, it's true of
oh, yeah.
any war.
Is this a POW MIA thing for them? Like uncle, whoever could still be alive?
A little bit of that started to kind of enter into the national conscience, right? Not a kind of wishful thinking. It was maybe a little bit more a feeling of embarrassment, because it's a within Japanese culture, it seems like it falls along a sort of conservative liberal breakpoint, where if you can imagine a contemporary situation where there was an American soldier somewhere in the mountains of Afghanistan who refused to believe that we had left Afghanistan and he was still out there fighting, how would that play in American newspapers?
It would depend on the paper.
It
would depend on the cable news channel,
it
right?
It would, right? There would be some that would be like, yeah, you know, those are the American values. And then there would be other people that would be kind of embarrassed.
Yeah, like, please stop shooting goats. Bring your kid home.
And that was true, I think, in Japan, too. In 1950, a young man, a private, by the name of Yuichi Akatsu, surrendered on the island of Lubang and said, I was in a group of four, and the other three guys are still up in the mountains. And the residents of the island of Lubang could confirm this because they, although it's a small island, had very little military significance. They were constantly being harassed by these guys that would come down out of the jungle and like knock over all their baskets, burn their rice harvests, steal some
breadfruit,
steal two bells and a cup, and disappear into the mountains, going yeah.
And that kind of thing stands out on a little island.
It
you
does.
Know, like you try that on Lopez or Orcas, and people will notice.
Yeah, that's right.
They're not from around here.
And worse things besides, they were this group that everyone on Luzon recognized. I'm sorry, not Luzon. Everybody on Lubang recognized were, I think, pretty early on recognized were Japanese soldiers. They were real jerks. They believed they were still sort of fighting a rear action, and so they were killing villagers.
Oh.
They were shooting people in the knee. They were, you know, they'd come around in the night and they'd, you know, steal the woofers and tweeters out of your speakers, and they'd make your toilet seat real cold.
I mean, we haven't mentioned this, but, you know, these people believed they were not just fighting a world war, but a holy war, right? They had been taught that their emperor was the descendant of the sun god, and that there was actually a theological imperative to do Hirohito's will, or they could face what divine retribution, right?
The practical war, I think, was the idea that the emperor was a god figure figured into the lack of or the unwillingness to surrender. But the practical aspect of the war, it seems like it was always strategic in their minds. We're here holding out until reinforcements come.
Huh.
And reinforcements are going to come because we, the Japanese, are meant to control the islands of the Pacific.
So it's more of a secular propaganda victory, you know, like, of course we're going to win. We've been told we're going to win.
Right.
I don't want to be the loose link in the chain.
Right. And also, you know, we're going to be lauded when we return home as heroes because we're the ones that kept the island, the crucial strategic island of Lubang, we held it by every once in a while killing somebody's cow and making it really hard for them to farm. They were a total irritation, and the residents of the island gradually started to leave certain fields fallow. It was one of these kind of like situations where kids wouldn't go out at night.
They're a cryptid now.
They were boogeymen.
They're Pennywise, yeah.
In 1954, this is 8 years, almost 9 years after the war ended, on the island of Lubang, a corporal by the name of Soichi Shimada was shot and killed by police during one of these raids. And it was then, I think, that people really understood that, I mean, this is, what, 9 years later. And so there was a concerted campaign. They knew who the people were.
They had name, rank, and serial number, right?
Yeah.
So.
There was a concerted campaign at that point to go to Lubang and try to convince them that the war was over. And they dropped leaflets that said, basically, the war ended back in August of 1945. Please come down from the mountains. Signed, everyone else in the world.
Yeah, I remember when they passed around the card. Yeah. Uh-huh.
They took letters and family pictures, dropped them from airplanes. And at one point, actually, some family members went to the island and went out into the jungle with megaphones and said, "It's me, your brother. The war is over." And the soldiers that we're discussing today watched and talked amongst themselves and decided that they were crisis actors.
These tricks are getting more and more devious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had so convinced themselves that it was impossible for the Japanese Empire to have surrendered, because that was inconceivable. And also it was impossible that America could have defeated Japan, because one is a corrupt nation.
It does seem a little unlikely in hindsight. I've met a few Americans.
Yeah.
Do you think there's some level of investment, like the sunk cost fallacy? Like, look, I've been living in these mountains for 10 years. It's terrible. There's no way that was a waste. I mean, if I were them, I would not be incentivized to come to grips with that either.
There's some of that, but it does suggest there are a lot of questions about this and the about their motivation, and the accounts that we have of these soldiers reflecting on their time, it may not surprise you to learn they're fairly self-serving accounts. And it really pleases us, and it pleased us in the 70s and 80s, to think that there were really still places in the world where people could still wake up every morning and salute the flag of a nation that no longer existed, and still be fighting a war of honor and tradition against coconuts. It's
a good story.
It
yeah.
tickles something yeah. in us. But in fact, just imagine them seeing the first jet airliner fly over.
Oh, that's true.
Imagine, I mean, they were not, none of them living in a completely, on an empty island, right? There would be no purpose in holding a waterless atoll, right? They're on islands that are inhabited. And watching people live and seeing technological advance and seeing what it is to be sharing an island with a peacetime economy.
People watching TV, people watching I Love Lucy dubbed into Tagalog.
Yeah. And you're there, living in a like a lean-to that you made out of banana leaves. There starts to be a kind of survivalist energy that can't quite be accounted for by just explaining that, oh, they didn't know the war was over. Yeah. And again, I think there are analogs to our contemporary society where you see the cult of militarization and of being prepared and of living off the land. Those can be their own sort of self-sustaining ideas, and you don't need much external justification.
Yeah, once it becomes a lifestyle,
yes.
inertia is going to keep you living the way... I mean, you're making it sound like some of these are going to go on for decades, and yeah, the more I think about it, they must just be... they're like, yeah, this is who I am now. Like, I'm now at an age where if I'm confronted with maybe some wrong lifestyle choice I'm making, I will just say, well, yeah, but isn't it too late? I'm 49 years old, and I know body wash is better than bar soap, but I'm just going to keep using bar soap.
No, it is not. Body wash is disgusting.
Really, we've really divided the crowd by age here. But you know what I mean, right? When you're in your 30s and the style of jeans change, you're like, oh, I'm going to wear those new jeans. Or, oh, I'm going to start saying, what's the 411? Or whatever it is. Whereas at my age, I'm like, I'm just going to wear this style jeans forever. I'm just going to say, what are the haps? Probably forever. I'm well aware that the war has ended in both cases, but it's a lifestyle now, you know?
You're really spilling the tea. Well, yes, but on the flip side of that, you also, as you get older, spend a lot more time in your comfortable chair, and to be continually making the decision to
stay in a cave,
to be sleeping in a cave into your 50s, as someone in his 50s, I like to see caves as I drive by on my way to a comfortable hotel room.
Is that what gets all these guys out of the jungle, is like arthritis?
Well, no, no. And an amazing part of this story is that I'm just describing the people that we know about.
Oh.
To think of how many hundreds, considering that there are hundreds that gradually
that
found their way
emerge.
Out, the many, many hundreds that we never heard about.
The better ones, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Not the ones who gave up, the ones who had the really good caves.
Yeah, as Donald Trump says, you know, I like the pilots that don't get shot down.
I like the Japanese that don't come out of the jungle.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're continuing their quiet war of devotion to the emperor.
I mean, right here, within 5 miles of where we're sitting, there are people that have 15 years worth of SpaghettiOs stockpiled in their basement, right? There is a very compelling desire to be ready and to be not fooled by modernity,
yeah,
by the comfort and...
And the fact that everyone's doing something different is not going to dissuade you. In fact, it's a sign of your superiority. Like, they're the ones who are not going to make it.
Right. The reason that this was all so present in our lives in the 1970s was that in October of 1972...
Wow.
You still weren't alive yet.
No.
But almost.
I'm getting close.
You were a glint in your mother's eye.
My parents are married in 72, so any day now.
But
or night.
By applause. By applause, how many of you were alive in 1972? Now, to those of you at home, you can't possibly see that the vast majority of people here are younger than that, because we're a very hip podcast, and most of the people in the room are in their 20s and 30s.
All the old people went to the space jazz at the main stage.
That's right. In 1972, a man by the name of Kinshichi Kozuka was shot in a shootout with the police on Lubang Island and killed. 27 years and 59 days after the end of World War II.
Is he one of the holdouts from the original Lubang Raiders we were discussing?
He was one of two who were still alive.
It's got to be easier when you got a buddy.
Yeah.
Like, if it was just me, I guess if it's just me in a cave, I'm going crazy in my own way. But if there's three other guys, you don't want to be the one to be like, should we, do you think the war might be over? Like, should we leave the cave? So I'm just kidding. No, we're not going to leave the cave. Sorry, I was just kidding.
The reappearance of Kozuka at this point, even dead Kozuka, shocked and stunned Japan and the world, because it was clear that he was not there alone. And everybody, I think, at the time knew who his partner in crime was, because his commanding lieutenant, Hiro Onoda. How did you pronounce his first name? Hiro?
Well, that's a problem. I was in Japan this summer, and I told a friend, hey, you were right. We went to Osaka, and it's great. And he was like, yeah, we love Osaka. And I was like, yeah, so much to see in Osaka. And he was like, we love Osaka. And this guy has turned into an Osaka guy, and he's laughing at me that I'm still saying anglicized Osaka. So I decided to get above his level, and now I say Nagoya instead of Nagoya. So there's just a question you have to decide: how much am I going to anglicize my Japanese pronunciation, and how try hard is it for an American to try that?
Did I ever tell you about the summer I spent in Budapest?
I was in Barcelona at the time, so I missed Budapest. Onoda.
Was a lieutenant who had been trained at an academy in this kind of subversive guerrilla warfare. And he'd actually been the commander of the group that had included Yuichi Akatsu, who had come out of the jungle in 1950, and Corporal Shimada, who was killed by the police almost nine years after the war ended. And in Japan, Onoda became a kind of like a cult figure, because people knew he was there, and the problem.
This was a time of some kind of militaristic revanchism in Japan, right? The political right were saying, you know, we're tired of being neutered by all these post-occupation policies. We should be a proud militaristic society as we once were. That must have really resonated.
That's exactly right. Here was this character who first seemed mythological, but once it became, and the thing is, the world has considerably shrunk by this point in time, because at the time, at the end of the war, Lubang was just an island that the Americans wouldn't have even bothered to stop by on their way. And by the 1970s...
Does it have a Four Seasons?
It doesn't, but if you look at the island now, it does have water parks. a lot of the South Pacific that then was terra incognita now is full of adventure tourism. It's part of it's part of the modern world. And in 1974, so 2 years after Kazuka was killed in a shootout.
I am born.
You are born. 1974, Ken Jennings is born. And future generations will mark that day as the beginning of the truly modern world. A Japanese who was described later by Onoda as a Japanese hippie, a student.
How does he know what hippies are? This is like an Encyclopedia Brown thing. This guy has no way to know what hippies are.
Yeah, I've now given away the end of the story, because he does eventually know what hippies are. A student by the name of Norio Suzuki, who was like an engineering student, and it was 72, and he probably had one of those jazz cigarettes or he listened to the Beatles, somehow realized that he didn't want to be an engineer anymore, and he wanted to go hitchhike around the world. And he set off and explored the world a little bit, got back to Japan, thought Japan was for nerds, and said, I'm going to be a citizen of the world, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to set off. And I'm gonna find three things. I'm gonna find a panda bear. I'm gonna find a Yeti, and I'm going to find Onoda, the missing lieutenant.
Wow! The dropout meets the holdout.
And so this kid flies to the island.
I would go panda first.
No. Doesn't fly.
Wouldn't you guys do panda first? much easier.
I think you're right. I think he maybe did it in order. No, he did it in order, but he put it in order with Onoda first.
Okay.
So panda second. Spoiler alert, he did find the panda.
If he found the Yeti, like, we are really bearing the lead.
Oh, no, wait, we'll save it. He didn't fly. He took a boat to the island. He went and talked to some people on the island. They were like, oh, yeah, there's still some asshole up in the forest that keeps stealing our cats. And so he climbs up into the jungle with a Japanese flag. I think there's a movie that was made where he had a tape recorder and he was just playing, like, patriotic songs of World War II.
like you can lure the guy out of the forest with this?
He did lure the guy out of the forest.
If somebody plays Sousa Marches at my house, I go back to bed. Like, it does not work on me.
You're not the target audience for
That's
this.
That's true.
And here comes Onoda out of the forest, still in his uniform that he's patched, and with his rifle still in good working order, 500 rounds of ammunition.
Wow. There are many like it, but this one is mine.
And he, like, hears the song and comes down out of the jungle, and here's this kid. And he said later, Onoda said, you know, I normally would have shot him, but he was wearing socks and sandals.
See, again, the opposite of my policy. So he's just fascinated with the
Well, no, he just figures no one that's from this island is from the Philippines would wear socks with sandals.
This guy is not a threat.
They would have sandals,
right?
No socks. If you had socks, it meant you were a well-to-do person, but then you would not be wearing them with sandals.
It confuses his his flowchart.
So he comes out, and the kid, you know, kid in his 20s, he's like, "Ha ha! Look at you! You're the guy!" And takes a selfie. Literally takes a selfie. Says, "Why don't you come back to Japan with me?" He says, "I can only surrender to my commander."
So they have to hope the CEO is still alive.
So the kid goes back to Japan, finds his commander, who was a major at the time and is now a little old man running a bookshop, and says, "Will you come back with me to this island in the Philippines, and this guy living in the mountains will only surrender to you?"
It'd be funny if you remember that guy and he was like, "Oh, hero.
I know. This guy,
that
come
guy's
on.
A guy. He was the worst."
But he does. The major goes with him. A delegation from Japan goes with him. And Hiro comes out of the jungle, surrenders.
What's the date?
It's March of 1974. After almost 30 years in the jungle.
Wow.
The last two of which living entirely alone after his best friend and companion was killed. And they fly him. The first thing they do, put him on a helicopter. Like,
that's not fair.
Guess what?
It's like just strapping somebody into a roller coaster.
Boom! And they take him to Manila, and he surrenders to Ferdinand Marcos. Hands over his sword that he's had this whole time. Ferdinand Marcos accepts it, forgives him of
Marcos,
all.
Marcos is loving it. This is like the most fun he gets to have that day, you know?
First thing Marcos says is, "Where's the gold? Did you hide any gold?"
Like, he got to kill some political prisoners that morning, but then, can you believe it? This guy gave me a sword.
He accepts the sword, forgives him of all crimes. He flies back to Japan, greeted as a hero, and is immediately politicized in this way you're describing, right? He becomes an emblem of a kind of conservative way of thinking about what Japanese culture really is, what it should be. He's a divisive figure right away. He has his autobiography ghostwritten that tells the story in all these kind of hagiographic terms.
Right. Is he all there? Like, is he
100%? He's in perfect shape. He's living on turtles, frogs, and rats for 30 years. Strong like bull.
But he's not just a nut.
Well.
I mean, we have a lot more awareness of mental health today, and I don't think anybody would prescribe what we just learned about Hiro Onoda for a vulnerable guy.
There are 1,000 people within a mile and a half of here who would absolutely prescribe it. Like, we should all be living in the Olympic Peninsula and, you know, eating pine cones.
If your kid's grades are bad, send him to a cave in the Philippines.
He tries to integrate back into Japanese society and finds that he hates it. It's full of hippies. And so he moves to a Japanese enclave in Brazil.
Really?
Because in Brazil, there was a very large community of Japanese expatriates who had gone to create... It's funny how South America attracts the people from the losing side of World War II. Let's go start our own little camp. So he became a cattle rancher there. And then
do you think he just like pretends it's like 1938 the whole time? Like, does that guy ever see Jaws or Star Wars, you know?
Well, so what we discover later was that in his raids on the island of Lubang, they raided a transistor radio in the mid-60s. They sat in their little hut and listened to the moon landing.
And argued about the Beatles and the Stones.
So the idea that they didn't know the war had ended just doesn't really pass muster.
It's a lifestyle. They preferred it.
Well, he did get put into this class of like special, otherworldly people, and kind of lauded, and even still, and particularly in the West, where we have a tendency to elevate Japan and Japanese culture and thinking and art as somehow
Yeah, very refined.
It's a refined
it's beyond
culture.
Beyond us, yeah.
What contemporary investigations have been uncovering is that basically he was a serial killer. He killed dozens of people for no good reason, burned down their huts, stole their underpants, and it wasn't funny to the residents of the island of Lübeck.
Like, we're allowed to have this very romantic view because we're an ocean away, but if you lived there, this guy's just the worst kind of criminal.
Yeah. So last year, no less a figure than Werner Herzog wrote his first ever novel about Onoda.
And what's his take?
Loves him.
What about the serial killing?
So a young woman by the name of Mia Stewart has been working for several years on a competing story where she actually went back to the island. She's a granddaughter of someone who lived there and has been in, and over the last 20 years has interviewed all of the residents of the island who were like, oh yeah, we remember that demon. He killed my uncle, my brother, and he ruined my wedding, and he stole my transistor radio.
Yeah.
She actually had a plan to interview him and was in Japan on the day he died. He had agreed to sit for an interview, and he died, leaving her to just attend his weird nationalistic funeral. He ended up opening an outdoor school for troubled youth.
Oh, really? Like Scared Straight?
He went back to Japan and was like, you know, here's how you live on rats and frogs.
Man, some things are universal.
The real tragedy is that Norio Suzuki, after bringing him back to Japan, went and found a panda, married a woman, and then was killed in an avalanche searching for yetis.
There is a lesson there.
Quit while you're ahead.
2 out of 3 ain't bad. And that concludes Hiroo Onoda, entry 867.1C1526, certificate number 4164, in the omnibus. Now, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, John and I were products of our time, and our posts are archived at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick on various platforms. I'm kind of the Hiroo Onoda of Twitter. Like clearly the war is over, but for some reason I'm still in the cave.
You're still there. Still there, eating frogs.
Like, my flag does not say long live Hirohito. It just says, like, why isn't Blue Sky out of beta yet? Get me out of here. Enthusiasts of this project, gather on the Futurelings Facebook group, subreddit. You can find Futurelings online. Our address for email, which was, in our time, a popular form of written electronic communication, was theomnibusproject@gmail.com. And often, physical artifacts were sent to us at The Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. This whole worthy project was made possible with the generous contributions of many supporters in our era. If Patreon exists in your era, please see patreon.com/omnibusproject and become a supporter today.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and fear that the catastrophe we pray is... No. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese. And hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.